we near year end, it is important and timely to take a fresh look at life insurance and charitable planning. The topic of today's broadcast with Steve Leinberg is integrating life insurance and charitable planning. Steve and I and several others teamed up a couple years ago to create the tools and techniques of charitable planning, published by the National Underwriter Company. So I know Steve is one of the country's leading experts on charitable planning.
Well, thanks, Randy. I'd like to take this opportunity to take a no-holds-barred look at why all too few professionals successfully enter into the charitable market or fail once they get there. And I'd like to talk about what works. I strongly believe that the charitable area can be a very lucrative market to the professional life insurance agent in every sense and in every dollar of the term. But it's also one which demands a surprising, in fact, astonishing amount to some, of technical knowledge, more than ordinary people skills, and a much higher level than normal of ethics and professional responsibility. Randy, the first thing people need to realize to be successful is that you will not be the first person to approach this charity, whatever charity it is that you approach. The second thing you need to be aware of, that every development director at almost any active charity can tell you a story about somebody who has offered a life insurance plan that purports to do great, make that incredible things for the charity. But in all too many cases, the claims or implications were that the plan, this plan costs nothing, and neither the charity nor the donor risks anything, and that there are few, if any, downsides. There's been almost an exponential growth in the number of such aggressive insurance programs being marketed to charities. Few charities have not been approached with a charitable life insurance proposal during the last few years.
So what's the problem, Steve?
Well, too many charities already have been stung. Some have been hurt with legal and ethical but overly optimistic arrangements where premiums that were to have vanished not only never did vanish, but those supposed to have vanished premiums climbed to such embarrassing levels that the charity's relationship with the insured donor was strained or even seriously threatened. Some of these arrangements are so far underwater that the charity has to use annual fund money to keep it floating, or the charity just gave up in disgust. These are problems of unrealized and unrealistic assumptions. Worse yet, other charities are still smarting from outright never could, never should work schemes. Examples include Charitable Split Dollar or investor-initiated and owned CHOLI, both of which have incurred congressional wrath, both of which have inspired legislation that either currently bars or severely discourages such arrangements. The problem is that before Congress acted, and it still hasn't completed that action in the case of CHOLI, a lot of charities' time and money was wasted, and more than a few charities and donors have been harmed, and they're very angry.
Steve, I'm not getting any shortage of calls on charitable and life insurance arrangements, why don't you tell our listeners what you mean when you talk about CHOLI?
CHOLI comes, as most of these investor-initiated and finance schemes do, it comes in many varieties. But in the classic arrangement, the charity creates a trust. The trust either sells fixed income shares or debt instruments to a third-party investor group. In other words, investors are one way or another financing the deal. Using the funds that they raise, the trust, again, ostensibly for the charity, the trust buys a significant number of life insurance contracts on the lives of the older and wealthier supporters of that charity. The charity, the bottom line is, the charity might receive, and an emphasis on the word might receive a small percentage of the proceeds, say 3 to 5%, but the remaining pool, the overwhelming majority of the proceeds, ends up in the hands of investors.
Steve, what does Congress think of these sorts of arrangements?
Well, Republican Senator Chuck Grassley and Democratic Senator Max Baucus stated, and I'm going to quote their words, "These arrangements do more to facilitate investment by private investors in life insurance than to further the charity's tax-exempt purposes." They went on to say that, and I hate this quote, but it is a quote, "These are snake oil salesmen taking advantage of tax-exempt organizations to line their own pockets with life insurance schemes." And that's a quote. "In my opinion, charitable split dollar and investor-initiated charitable life insurance schemes violate the most important principle in charitable planning." And that's very simple. Charity is and should be about giving, not taking.
Steve, since August or September, I've got an increasing amount of calls from folks talking about charitable and life insurance arrangements. And I don't know how many times I could tell you what I have heard is that Congress is okay with these now. Congress has looked at them. They're all right. We're okay to go forward on these. You should take a new look at them. Can you tell me and tell our listeners where Congress really is on this issue as far as what you can tell?
Yes. Well, Congress is definitely not all right with these. Although the Pension Protection Act of 2006 did not contain what we expected, and it's still sitting in the hopper, a 100% excise tax on these kinds of contracts. And this was proposed jointly by one Democrat and one Republican, where it was a joint bill by Grassley and Baucus, 993, and it did contain. So what I'm saying to you is, when all the smoke cleared with the Pension Protection Act contains code section 6050V. 6050V is in Victor. Code section 6050V mandates, effective for acquisitions of contracts after the 17th of August 2006, so it's already effective, this code section mandates reporting by charities for the next 2 years on acquisitions of interest in life insurance contracts in which the charity holds an interest. Now, we're talking about these CHOLI contracts. This code section requires that charities which engage in CHOLI arrangements must file a return, must show the name, the address, the TIN, the taxpayer identification number, of the charity and the issuer of the applicable insurance contract and other required information. There is a penalty imposed on charities that don't report CHOLI transactions, unless, of course, it's shown that the failure is due to reasonable cause and not to willful neglect. And there's even a 10% penalty in the value of the benefit of any contract if there is intentional disregard of this rule.
On top of that, Steve, didn't the Pension Protection Act also require that there be a study done on this issue?
Yes. The Treasury has been instructed to undertake a 30-month study on the use by tax-exempt orgs of these kinds of arrangements to determine, and here is the kicker, to determine if they are consistent with the tax-exempt status of these organizations. Now, let me mention Conrad Tytel's take on all this. As you know, Conrad Tytel is one of the country's leading experts on charitable planning and charitable taxation. In an article entitled "Charity's Interest in Insurance Policies" in his newsletter, Tax-Wise Giving, Conrad Tytel asked the question, if the IRS determines that these schemes are inconsistent with a charity's tax exemption, can that exemption be lost? His advice, don't test the IRS.
That's a scary thought, a loss of charitable exemption. But Steve, you and I have been looking at charitable programs for a long time. When we first started to work together, now I guess it's been over 10 years ago, we started when we did our Duel of the Century. A lot of people will remember that. We were talking about uses of charitable planning at that point in time. It's been a long road, and it doesn't seem like there's any shortage of these things. Schemes like charitable split dollar and a lot of these other arrangements make it very hard for life insurance professionals to get off on the right foot when they go in and talk to folks at these charities.
I think that's a very good point, Randy. I think a smart insurance professional will start by putting himself or herself in the shoes of the development officer, the person sitting on the other side of that desk. When presented with a proposal, any proposal, their job is to balance objectivity, efficiency, knowledge, common sense. They have to be open-minded, they have to be courteous, and sometimes they have to add a great deal of personal integrity and courage. And when they do that, when they look at your proposal, they must decide one of three things. Do I reject this proposal outright? Do I give it full and immediate and serious consideration? Or do I put this in my desk drawer until some appropriate time in the future? Do I table it? Now, one factor that will make a significant difference between your success and possible failure is your ability to see and solve the charity's problems looking through the eyes of the person that you want to buy your idea. So let's assume you are a donor, or you are a fundraiser, or you are the development officer, or a charitable executive, or you're a member of the board of directors, and somebody's put in front of you, or somebody's just given you what looks like a great way to benefit your favorite charity. Now, of course, you don't want to be bothered with a lot of tax law or technical gibberish, and in all probability, you may not know a great deal about the tax laws involved. But you do care, and you know that you must both read or listen to the proposal, and you've got to react in one of those three ways we just talked about. You need to know the mistakes that others less concerned than you have made and what to do to avoid them. And since you're involved in the decision-making process, I think you have an obligation to know the many positive things about life insurance, how life insurance can benefit your charity in simple, ethical, and easy-to-implement and manage ways. You need to know how life insurance can help your organization fulfill your charitable purposes to a degree that might otherwise not be possible. But let's face it, you can't concentrate on the good things about life insurance, what it can do for your charity, until you've eliminated or you alleviate at least some of your fears and some of your concerns. So I think that our listeners have got to really understand what fears or what concerns go through the minds of a charitable development officer. I think your concerns about life insurance start with this. I think they start with, I don't have time. I don't have the knowledge. I don't have the energy. I don't have the money. I don't have the staff. I don't have the resources to hire counsel or experts to investigate every life insurance scheme that comes along. I could spend my whole life, pardon the pun, analyzing these plans. No sooner have we investigated one arrangement than another purportedly different one, better one, comes along. Or you may be thinking, are we going to be betting against our own donors' lives? If we go along with this proposal, are we risking our organization's reputation? Or perhaps your concern is life insurance gifts are by definition delayed gifts. We're driven by annual gifts. We need the cash now. You might also be worried that I'm just not comfortable with life insurance. I don't know enough about it. It scares me. Or we're not going to know whether this thing works for years. Or possibly your big concern is if we do get involved, will this person be there for us? Will this agent, will this broker, what happens if things don't go as we expect or as well as this person is projecting? Will this person be there to tell us what went wrong, why, or what our options are, how to fix this problem? Or, as a development officer, you may resist the proposal because she's telling me this would be a great thing for our charity, but it feels more like they will be exploiting our organization's relationship with our donors. This may not be in the best interest of our donors, and I need to put our donors first. Besides which, this arrangement totally bypasses relationship building. And the final straw might be that this just doesn't feel right. It may make money for us, but in reality, there is no charitable intent. It's just a tax or dollar juggling scheme, and it doesn't start and end with a donor who wants to make a positive difference.
Steve, I think you make a lot of good points. I'm very active in one of the charities here in the Boston area, and a friend of mine is a development officer there. And, you know, just to summarize, what is going on in the mind of a smart officer when they're sitting down and looking at some of these insurance programs that are proposed to them?
When an experienced, when an ethical, when a competent charitable development officer begins the analysis of your life insurance proposal, he or she will or should start by asking himself or herself if it is likely and reasonable that adopting your proposal will result in a positive net value for the charity and simultaneously assist the charity's donors in the achievement of their charitable and personal objectives.
All right, I'll put you on the spot here, Steve. Specifically, what would this person be looking at in your view?
I think there are three sine qua non considerations that must be met before a charity should be willing to do business with you. First, the prime motivation for the contribution, no matter what form it takes, the prime motivation should be the donor's strong desire to support the work of the specific charitable institution involved. Second, there should be complete disclosure to both the donor and the charity of every party's role and relationship in the transaction. Third, all the parties involved should act with fairness, with honesty, with integrity, and openness. I think except for fair and reasonable compensation for services you actually render, you, the seller, should have no vested interest that could result in personal gain or cause a conflict of interest with either the donor or the charity. In a nutshell, even before a charity's development officer begins to critically examine whether or not your proposal works on a technical level or on an economic level, he or she should be asking, are the marketers and the donors involved really trying to do something wonderful for our organization, or is their objective mainly to take something valuable and important from it? Is there true philanthropic intent? What does my gut, what does my instinct tell me?
I think we're on the right path here. I really think if you can't get past that officer, that development officer, that this isn't going to go anywhere. What kind of questions should our producers expect those officers to ask when they come to them with an insurance program?
Well, I don't think there are any right questions or right order of questions or right number of questions, but let me give you some things, some questions which, if asked and answered positively, if you can really answer these things, if you can anticipate these things, if you could put these into your proposal, I think they will significantly increase the probability of a pleasing, positive outcome and a mutually profitable relationship. Now, one question I'd ask you if I were representing a charity and you were trying to sell me an insurance proposal, one question I'd ask is, how can I tell if what you're trying to sell us is legally legitimate, morally ethical, and economically viable? I'd certainly want to know, Randy. I'd want to know your background. Are you willing to provide us, Mr. Zipsy, with the names and phone numbers of references? I'd certainly ask, what local charities have you actually implemented this arrangement with and with you? How many of these plans have you set up and how many are running now? Is a major and well-known insurer backing this proposal? Is that insurer willing to provide us with a letter assuring our organization that the tax and the other legal representations you made are correct. List the assumptions. What are the variables that, if they don't work as we planned or as you've projected, what are these assumptions or variables that could significantly impact on your proposal's outcome? What downsides, what disadvantages, what exposures are faced by our organization or our donors? Will you provide us with a best, a worst, a probable range of rewards and of costs? What is our maximum downside, or what's our maximum upside? If interest rates, if mortality assumptions, and the cost of insurance increase or decrease beyond the expected, beyond the anticipated, beyond the parameters that you are illustrating. I certainly want to know, Randy, do you have a backup plan for us? If we start this proposal, this project, and for some reason we have to cut back or stop, do you have a backup plan for it? Do you have a well-defined, written exit strategy? And if so, what's it going to cost? What are the fines? What are the penalties? What other costs might we incur if we have to get out? How long does it take, does it have to run for this thing to work from our point of view?
Steve, now let's flip over and look at the other side. I know you as well are very active in charitable organizations. What sort of questions are the development officers and the charities going to be asking?
Well, you're right. I'm very active in United Cerebral Palsy and several other charities, and this is a very good point. Among the internal questions, a smart development officer will be asking herself or himself are these. What is our organizational risk-taking propensity? Does this proposal that this person's offering contain risks that are beyond our tolerance levels? What additional human resources, what kind of effort, what kind of financial commitment will this proposal require of our staff, either initially or continually? Do we have to sign a non-disclosure agreement, which of course is a no-no? Will there be securities or UBTI, unrelated business taxable income? Will there be private benefit or private endowment impacts on our charity? Will our tax-exempt status be risked if, in implementing this proposal, we happen to provide inappropriate and obviously disproportionate benefits to some individual or some investor group or some business? I think this was the central concern that Conrad Tytel expressed about Choli plans. Do we have the requisite state law insurable interest? Whenever you're dealing with life insurance and charities, the first thing you need to know is, does the charity have insurable interest? How dependent is success on an as-yet-unobtained favorable interpretation of a combination of steps? Is there a case, is there a public ruling that gives us some assurance that this proposal will work as this person has stated it will work? You know, all too often, each step in a proposal is blessed by a favorable case or ruling. But you know, in reality, it's a lot like gasoline and fire. Each step may be fine by itself, but what will happen when you combine gasoline and fire? Is there a step transaction problem? When the courts, when the IRS looks at this whole thing as a totality, when it looks at it not only on paper, but when it looks at it in operation, is this deal kosher? What will be the impact on our success if Congress or a state legislator or a court were to change the specific law upon which success in this proposal is based? Are there restrictions on our organization's ability to discontinue paying premiums or divest ourselves of the life insurance at some future date? Can we get out? Does a donor have to die for our organization to profit? How long are we going to have to wait for the money that we're promised under this proposal, and can we afford that time delay? Will we have to borrow? Does this entail us borrowing money to finance life insurance premiums? And even if we do not borrow, how would the arrangement impact on our charity's credit status? How will the transaction be shown on our charity's books? Will someone other than our charity or its beneficiaries or clients, will some third-party investor profit under this arrangement? What, aside from the pleasure of benefiting the charity's objectives, what does the donor receive? What does the donor expect to receive? There are more questions, Randy. Are that donor's expectations realistic? Are they ethical? Are they legal? Is this the best type of gift from the donor's perspective? Every once in a while, you have to turn it around and say, what's not the best thing for the charity? What's the best thing for the donor for him to be giving? Is this the best kind of gift for him or her to be giving? What debt instruments, what contracts, what other legal instruments will we have to sign? And what is the maximum extent of our financial obligations or other obligations under these documents? Does our charity have to provide any collateral? Do we have to give any guarantees? One of the things that a really smart development officer will ask is what installation fees, what maintenance fees, what termination fees, what other charges are involved? Is it possible for us to lose assets if we go through with this proposal? If the assumptions made in this piece of paper do not, in fact, occur, will additional premium payments be required from us, from our general funds, or from our donors? Or what happens to the death benefit we've anticipated? Will that be reduced? Does the proposal fit in with our organization's current cash flow, with our short-term needs, with our long-term needs? Can we afford to divert resources? Can we afford to divert money from today's demands? That's one of the biggest questions that every charity has to ask. Can we afford not to think, there's two things going on at the same time. Can we afford to divert resources from today's demands? And at the same time, a smart planner's got to say, can we afford not to think about the future of our organization? Can we live with the inability to know when we will receive cash flows from life insurance proceeds? What portion of our investment portfolio and long-term success will be represented by this plan? Is it a large portion? Is it a small portion? What impact, if any, will the program have in attracting new and really true donors? And what impact will it have on the retention and encouragement and development of our current benefactors? A couple more questions. How will our supporters react when they know our organization has a vested interest in their premature death? In other words, will we have an adverse PR if we're betting against our donors' longevity? Are there ethical issues or possible adverse perceptions that we need to consider? Does this proposal feel and sound just plain swarmy? Do we have sufficient and competent staff and legal counsel, or can we cost-effectively hire independent advisors who are able to do such things as a present value analysis of our expected outlays and compare those outlays with the present value of our anticipated economic benefits, the death benefit expected to be received from the policy or policies in the future? And I guess a couple more questions I'd ask is, do we have access to somebody who can provide us with an objective comparative analysis of various policies and the financial soundness, the credit rating, the debt rating of the insurance companies involved? And finally, Randy, and I know I've gone through a lot of questions, but certainly another question is, do we have or can we obtain at reasonable cost legal counsel who can assure us that the program complies with applicable state insurable interest and other relevant state and federal laws?
Steve, you certainly raise a lot of very good questions, and a lot of the ones that I see in a lot of the programs that come past my desk. I certainly see a lot of charitable-owned programs where if you look at the proposal that the charity gets, it looks like it makes economic sense, but when you start to pick apart the mortality assumptions, you have to ask yourself, is this really going to work as illustrated? What kind of mortality assumptions are underlying these? If you're dealing with standard mortality as opposed to underwritten mortality, you know, a lot of these things start to fall apart. And, you know, and I know from a lot of the, you know, the charitable split dollar arrangements and some of the other arrangements that have been sold over the years where there have been charities that have gotten involved in those, and those sorts of arrangements have went bad for the donors, and they've lost relationships with people who have had bad tax results. I also know, you know, officers, charitable officers, who have been involved with charitable programs, some of these and these annuity arbitrage sort of deals where somebody has had a large insurance contract bought on their life, but the charity is only going to get a small percentage of that, say 3 or 4%. But when the development officer goes back to that insured, the insured says, well, I just gave a $10 billion life insurance contract to you. But in reality, you know, 9.7 of that is going to, you know, to going to the bank and not to the charity. So, you know, a lot of these issues I think you need to look at when you start to go through these arrangements.